Hey there, Grey Wolves. This is Amber Lee Frost here with a very special episode of Chapo Trap House. We have here with us Aaron J. Leonard, one of the authors of A Threat of the First Magnitude, FBI Counterintelligence and Infiltration from the Communist Party to the Revolutionary Union, 1962 to 1974. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Amber. It's great to finally get to talk.
This is, first of all, an incredible book because it's just an incredible story. I think most people who are familiar with left politics know something about COINTELPRO. They know a little bit about counterintelligence. I'm not sure if people know the exact scope and comprehensiveness of the sort of government interference in left organizing from the very beginning. So I was wondering if we could start out with just a definition. What is counterintelligence and what is COINTELPRO and what is the difference between the two?
Well, counterintelligence is it's a doctrine based, essentially a military doctrine, where you're trying to undermine your enemy. You know, your enemy is operating kind of, you know, in the United States, you could have forces operating as a foreign agent or as domestic subversion, and counterintelligence is trying to undermine that, you know, through secret means. You know, it's not a, you know, not a declared adversarial relation. It's operating in the background. COINTELPRO itself was a program that began in the 50s by the FBI aimed at the Communist Party USA. And it was a discrete program aimed at really undermining and destroying the party. It evolved as the 60s kind of, you know, started to get more dynamic and more threatening to the standing authority to be, there was a counterintelligence black extremist aimed at groups like the Black Panthers, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, at individuals like Martin Luther King and James Forman. There was also a counterintelligence new left aimed at groups like SDS and later groups in the new communist movement. Another aimed at Puerto Rican independence advocates. I think it ended up being like six or seven different COINTELPROs. And this is what most people know. It's, you know, they know about the poison pen letters that were sent to Jeff Fort and his street organization in Chicago to try to, you know, rile them up against the Black Panthers in Chicago. They know about the secret letter sent to Martin Luther King encouraging him to essentially kill himself because the FBI was on to his having extramarital affairs. I mean, King didn't know the FBI was writing to him. It was written as an outside exposure. So they're different things. And the FBI has engaged in counterintelligence program, in counterintelligence, you know, the kind of broader thing more overall under the cover of something called internal security investigations, which were kind of the currency in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. COINTELPRO, you know, the actual named organization is a lot of what people know, and unfortunately, it's where things start and stop. You know, I was a Maoist for many years, and kind of fancied myself kind of up on this stuff and, you know, had read this. But, you know, when I stopped that, you know, I stopped being a Maoist, and I'm not quite sure what I am today. I'm a writer, if anything. But I reexamined, you know, what it is that a group like the FBI actually does. And it just kind of led me further and further to want to get deeper and deeper to understand it, because I think people today who are, you know, from whatever, you know, stepping off point, you know, looking for social justice, looking for a better world, you know, it's really in their interest to understand how this works actually versus a lot of received wisdom or a lot of shorthand.
Sure. So I read that the kind of big kind of counterintelligence programs started with Hoover in like 1919 to target left-wing immigrants mostly. And the CPUSA was the biggest target, and it was because they supported the Soviets, correct?
Well, it evolved, you know, and the Russian Revolution kind of created the FBI to try to undermine people in the United States who would support it. In the 1920s, there were these mass roundups of radical, mainly European, I believe, immigrants in something called the Palmer Raids. Palmer was the attorney general. Hoover was a young lawyer working for him. But, you know, beyond the 20s into the 30s, the Communist Party started to become the major radical force in the United States, and they did support the Soviets. And the FBI, with the support of, you know, the president, people like Roosevelt, and the attorney generals in the Justice Department, they countered that, and they countered it aggressively. So the 30s and 40s and the 50s, the FBI became much more sophisticated in trying to undermine the Communist Party USA. You know, the Communist Party in the United States had something like 80,000 people by the end of World War II. So it was kind of on the way to becoming something like a Euro-Communist Party. And then in the 50s, you know, the U.S. kind of set everything it could against that party, both in the media and by unleashing the FBI to undermine it. I mean, to be a communist in 1950 was probably worse than being a pedophile as far as social acceptability. Mm-hmm. But then the FBI kind of met this new challenge, you know, in the wake of the civil rights movement and then the Black Freedom Movement. You know, this whole new thing emerged, which inevitably, or not inevitably, but one of the biggest organized forms to come out of the 60s was the new communist movement, which more Maoism and Castroite communism. And, you know, the FBI was, and, you know, they had the Black Panther Party, which was kind of a mixed bag of pro-China, pro-Cuba, black nationalists. So they had all these other threats, and that became the big thing. It was kind of the rock that smashed them too, you know, because by the mid-70s, a lot of reorganization had to go on. And we talk about that some in the book. So, you know, the FBI's had decades of experience, you know, and they weren't always as good as they became, but they became very sophisticated. And that's one of the things we get into in the book is it's not like every FBI agent was sophisticated, but they, you know, they had a small cohort who actually took the time to understand the groups they were targeting, and they understood geopolitics, and this made them very effective at recruiting informants and attempting to undermine these groups.
Sure. So CPUSA was the biggest target, but you mentioned that they branched out into infiltrating groups that they referred to as black extremists, the Socialist Workers Party, the New Left, and the Klan. That seems like, let's say, a grab bag of organizations. What exactly sort of qualified you to be considered a threat by the Bureau of Investigation, later the FBI?
Well, you know, that's a good question because, you know, there actually is a method to it. I mean, you know, the FBI is fundamentally tasked with protecting the internal security of the United States. You know, the CIA has a more international scope. I mean, you know, aside from the kind of euphemistic language they package themselves in, it's pretty brutal stuff what they do. But, you know, the FBI was concerned with organizations that, particularly organizations with ties to foreign countries. So the Communist Party was generally, by and large, their biggest target and the biggest target of their COINTELPRO operations, their informant penetration, because they had ties to the Soviet Union. You know, the history of the last half of the 20th century is the struggle between, you know, the capitalist West and the, you know, the communist East, such as it was. So this was real stuff. And the Soviets, even though the Communist Party in the 60s was dwindling and, you know, almost insignificant in terms of, you know, its effect in these larger movements, it still was, you know, directly aligned with the Soviet Union. The FBI had an informant in the Communist Party who was essentially like the Secretary of State for that group. Gus Hall led the party, in the late 50s into the 60s. But he had this guy, Morris Childs, mm-hmm. who was his liaison, who went to the Soviet Union. He talked to Khrushchev. He met with Mao Zedong. He met with Brezhnev. He figured out payments that the Soviets were kind of underwriting the work of the Communist Party USA. I mean, you know, from the Soviet standpoint, they needed an agent in the United States. And I'm not saying the individual cadre of the Communist Party were aware of this. This is at the very top of the organization. But they recruited Morris Childs from the party in 1952 when he was sick and vulnerable. They sent this FBI agent from Chicago, this guy Carl Freeman, to go to Morris Child's apartment. He was sick in bed. He had a heart trouble. He kind of left the party. His wife had left him.
Yeah, yeah. Like they literally found him when he was recovering from like a heart attack, and his wife had left him. He had been made a pariah by the party too. It was interesting. The guy Browder was the name.
Yeah, Browder was a follower of Browder. His mentor. Yeah,
Browder was disgraced. So his mentor disgraced. He got pushed out. I'm sure he had a lot of bitterness towards the party, and his life was really miserable. So it seems like one of their all-time most useful informants, someone who literally had, you know, practical and useful conversations with Mao, was a former very committed and formerly trusted party member.
Yeah, the guy had keys to every office, metaphorically. But, you know, the way you even said that, it's like, it's just cold-blooded, right? It's like, let's get this guy at his most vulnerable, and then let's go to work on him. And that's exactly what they did. But, you know, beyond the kind of, you know, that moral problematic, there is, it was a strategy. They had this program in the 50s called Top Lev. You know, the Communist Party was like in a mess in the early 50s. Their leaders had been sent to jail for sedition under the Smith Act. They were playing with, you know, taking a part of their organization underground. They had lost thousands of people. They were in internal turmoil. And then the FBI said, well, this is a good time to go interview leaders and try to flip them. You know, they had this campaign called Top Left for Top Level. And they systematically went after everybody they could identify as leaders of the group to, you know, quote unquote, interview them. And when the FBI interviews them, this is not a passive thing. This is it's either trying to intimidate people or trying to kind of beat the bushes to see if there's the potential to turn somebody into an informant, or, you know, just try to garner information that otherwise wouldn't be available. So this doctrine, you know, we kind of discovered this is what they did. I mean, not just with the Communist Party, but then into the new communist movement and the Black Freedom Movement, is they really tried to get people in the top of organizations because, you know, that gives them the most initiative. And they were reasonably successful with this. But Morris Childs, like you said, he was the most successful. And the guy was an agent for 25 years, and it never got exposed until the academic David Garrow discovered in researching Martin Luther King that the FBI had this thing called Operation Solo. You know, Morris Childs was, him and his brother were Operation Solo, you know, the top informants in the Communist Party USA.
One of the weird things to me is just the density of informants they had. You mentioned at its height, I think in 1968, and just going to SDS for a second, they had 300 chapters, and they said they had an informant in every chapter, and some chapters had more than one informant. Now that, I mean, I can see it was an insurgent movement. It had grown massively from like 300 people to 300 chapters in like 5 years. But for CPUSA, I mean, you said they had like 80,000 members in 1944. By 1962, they were down to like 5,000 members, and they still had the same number, roughly, of informants, like 431 informants. And assuming those informants were, you know, like dues payers, that's 8.5% of the membership of CPUSA. How would you justify that number?
Yeah, it's a pretty rough legacy for the CPUSA. I guess, you know, I'm still understanding this, but one of the things we discovered in writing the book is there's a quality to it. There's informants who give casual bits of information, and then there are informants who actually operate at the very top level of organizations. SDS, like you mentioned, I think at their peak, they claimed 100,000 people. You know, how many of them were actually committed day-to-day activists would be a good deal less. But yeah, the FBI had informants in all those chapters. So, and I suspect most of them were just, quasi-casual members, but the FBI did exercise a certain control over them. I mean, one of the things we discovered is that, the FBI, or excuse me, SDS had a huge schism in 1969. They had this kind of conventional Marxist-Leninist group called Progressive Labor trying to exert influence in the group. And then they had the National Office, which was much more radical, would go on to become the Weathermen. And then there was a larger mass of kind of radical students, not inclined to either pull, but more tactically aligning with the National Office. The FBI actually instructed its informants to vote with the National Office. And the rationale was, look, these people are going to go off and do political violence. They're going to break laws, and we can go after them full force. If this group, Progressive Labor Party, takes charge, they're more savvy politically. They're not going to charge off and do kind of reckless things. And in the long haul, they're going to be more dangerous. That was their assessment, at the moment. But, they actually instructed their considerable cadre of informants to vote with the National Office in that case. But the point is, there is informants at low levels, and then there's kind of an elite who go in and operate for as long as they can and do considerable, they have influence, and, from the standpoint of the organizations, can do a good deal more damage.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's interesting the contrast. At one point, there's an anecdote where the FBI paid two, in their own words, vagrants, $1 each, I believe, to just go into a May Day crowd and distribute flyers.
Yeah, that was wild, right?
Yeah.
That was in a document. And you can see that's easy. And they got away with it, as near as I can tell.
Sure.
Actually, what was more interesting to me, well, not so much more interesting, but that reminds me of another thing that happened, is how blind the left can sometimes be, is the FBI was circulating this phony document in the ranks of the Communist Party, which pretended to be a pro-Maoist faction within the Communist Party USA, and they circulated this thing called the Ad Hoc Bulletin for a Scientific Socialist Line. And the leaders of the Communist Party discovered that this bulletin was circulating. The idea was Communist Party members would read the bulletin and become all riled up against the Soviet policies, and the FBI leveraged that dissent to create dissension in the group. Quite a number of people were kicked out of the Communist Party for adhering to this ad hoc bulletin. But the thing is, so this ad hoc bulletin is circulating, and the first thing the communists think is, oh my God, the Trotskyists, they're the ones that have done this.
Right,
and
they're not.
They're not thinking it's the FBI. They're thinking it's another left sect.
Yeah, one of my favorite lines in the book is, they did not assume there were forces more hostile than the Trotskyists.
Yeah, right?
Right, right. Well, let's back up a little bit. Why don't you tell us what the Ad Hoc Committee for a Marxist-Leninist Party is?
Oh, it's a trip. And this is where I start to sound like Glenn Beck with his convoluted organization.
I know. It's really hard to read this book without feeling insane. But I assure you, one of the best parts of it is that half of it is primary documents. So you can go and look at all of these things so you know that you're not just losing your mind.
Yeah, well, I was trying to cover my back a little bit because, it does sound a little out there, without actually, if there's no grounding. The Ad Hoc Committee in 1962, it's the brainchild of this guy, Herbert K. Stallings, who's a special agent in the Chicago Counterintelligence Office, whose main task is to undermine the Communist Party USA. We discovered the ad hoc committee, through the work of this guy, David Sullivan, who was a Revolutionary Union member who had left and was briefly researched it in 1980 and kind of he stored a few files in the NYU Tamamet Library that we discovered. He wasn't able to fully resolve, you know, what the ad hoc committee was, but through the efforts of an academic Art X team, we got hold of a document that prominently had the name of Herbert K. Stallings that also seemed to be associated with the ad hoc committee. So I Googled ad hoc committee and Herbert Stallings, and what appeared was the personnel file of Carl Freeman. Carl Freeman is the guy who recruited Morris Childs. Carl Freeman is the Chicago FBI supervisor of the counterintelligence program. In his file is a clearly stated articulation of what the ad hoc committee is. And it says that it came out of the imagination of S.A. Herb Stallings, and its idea was to be a pro-Maoist construct in the pro-Soviet Communist Party USA. I'm paraphrasing the last bit, but it spells out in meticulous detail that, you know, we're going to build a fake Maoist sect inside the Communist Party USA. You know, just to give you a sense of that, it would be like a pro-Trump faction in the Democratic Party. These things are irreconcilable. To be a pro-Maoist in 1963 in the Communist Party USA because they're passing polemics back and forth and they're really hating each other. But this guy Stalin starts to produce these bulletins, you know, and they're reasonably sophisticated. And as time goes on, the bulletin gets more and more sophisticated. The group is around for, I think, 10 or 15 years. And they changed their name to the Ad Hoc Committee for a Marxist-Leninist Party. Never once make any effort to actually build a Marxist-Leninist Party while other people are doing it. But they weigh in, and they're kind of respected among, you know, those in the know, even though they're super secret and nobody really knows what the deal is. But they intervene in all kinds of stuff. And like we write in the book, there are 15,000 to 17,000 pages on this group that are slowly going to get released. I should be getting 200 pages in a year. I mean, I'll be dead when all this stuff finally comes out. But I strongly suspect when the full program of the ad hoc committee is written, you know, it's going to probably change our conception of some of the stuff of the 60s, because, you know, we know they were involved in the Revolutionary Union. We know they were involved in the Communist Party USA. We have evidence that they were involved in progressive labor parties. So they were amid and among some of the major players doing the devious work.
Right. I mean, it seems like the Bureau had done things like this before on a smaller scale before, just to, like, they would make fake organizations like the, Red People's Union of Louisiana or something like that, and so that they could write recommendations for people, so that they could say, right, oh, this person is on the up and up, and that way they could embed themselves because they have a reference from a supposedly legitimate organization. But the Ad Hoc Committee for a Marxist-Leninist Party, it was a massive undertaking, and it was huge, and it wasn't real, and it completely threw everything into chaos. Now, they were able to do this because of the Sino-Soviet schism, correct?
Yeah, it's a puzzle, because nobody ever. And this is the thing with the FBI, is they're really good at keeping secrets. I mean, some of the stuff they were forced to disclose. I mean, everybody knows about the COINTELPRO Black Panthers, but, you know, we started researching the Maoist Revolutionary Union. We've got thousands of pages. I think we might even have 10,000 pages on that group. And that says to me that, you know, Progressive Labor Party, there's got to be thousands and thousands of pages. This is massive. And the way something like the Ad Hoc Committee reaches into it is, look, it's cause for speculation. But we do know, we discover. My collaborator, Connor Gallagher, he's actually working in China, so he's not always available for interviewing. But, you know, he got the notion to go look through the papers of Morris Childs. Morris Childs, again, is this Secretary of State for the Communist Party and an FBI informant to see if we could find anything about the ad hoc committee in his personal papers. And sure enough, he's got a full catalog of all the papers. And the suspicion is that he helped write the later versions. The later versions are very nuanced in Marxism, Leninism, especially in what Marxists call the black nationalist question. And they do these flips in their political stand. You know, 1 year they say this, and 2 years later they say the exact opposite, and nobody even picks up on it, because technology is such as how do you compare all these documents unless sure. you're keeping a file, and they're distributed secretly, so it's hard to keep that file. But
and it's only because they had Marxists or former Marxists on staff as informants that they were able to imitate the language it looks legit. That's how communists talked back then. When you read these these ad hoc kind of newsletters, they were speaking to like a kind of legitimate factionalism that already existed on some level among the left. You had people supporters of the Soviet Union suddenly in contention with people who are moving more towards Mao. And it was very, on a case-by-case basis, it's very believable. But like you said, it was kind of inconsistent. If you were able to see all of them at once, it starts to look a little shaky. Like, for example, they switched positions entirely on black nationalism, correct?
Yeah, they did. And at a point when it was becoming very volatile. I mean, one of the most extensive parts of the book deals with this effort by a number of organizations, the Black Workers Congress, Young Lords Party, which had become something called the Puerto Rican Revolutionary Workers Organization, the Revolutionary Union, and Iwar Kyun. Along with this group, the October League and the Guardian, they were all trying to come together to form, a new communist party, that was pro-Chinese and pro-Mao. And the ad hoc committee took the position that the time was not right, that black workers should lead black workers, Puerto Rican workers should lead Puerto Rican workers. So they took that position in a letter to this newspaper, the Guardian. The head of the Revolutionary Union delegation in the committee that was trying to get this merger was this guy named Don Wright. Don Wright had joined the RU, and his political bona fides were he had been in the ad hoc committee, and he put out the same position. It was the opposite position of what his organization was actually, telling him to put. And the end result is the union never came together. The Revolutionary Union went on and formed a party by itself, but they totally, the whole thing was derailed, and it seems like the ad hoc committee and Don Wright played a significant role. I mean, look, these were big questions, and they are contentious and complicated questions, and we see that today. So that was definitely in effect, but there was something secret going on in the background. I did want to say one thing, though, because, your characterization of the sophistication of these documents, it's really important. I mean, there's two things. Actually, I talked recently in one city, and somebody came up to me after and said, well, it's really interesting what you're saying, Aaron, but it's also depressing. sure, it is. But then, and that kind of counterposes, I know from having been a Maoist, we proclaim this thing that line is key. And I think there was a spoken and unspoken notion that somebody in the FBI or a police agent could never be that sophisticated politically. If you really believe this stuff, it was hard to speak it, unless you were really steeped in it. But I think our book proves that, look, if you just study the documents and the literature, you can get pretty good at it. And there's no mysticism to it. It's kind of like learning algebra in a sense.
Sure.
But getting back to the point of being depressing is no, it's a lot better to know what's going on instead of just kind of being victimized by it. And I think that's one of the things, this book and our first book is trying to do is, to kind of let people know that there is a methodology behind it. and it works a certain way. And, you know, it's worth understanding that, and people can do with that what they want. But if you do that, it's not as depressing. You know, it does mean that the terrain is a little bit more, you know, a good deal more dangerous than maybe you thought, but at least you know what the terrain is.
Right. I mean, I think it is a little depressing. To me, it's more like mystifying. 'Cause from the very first ad hoc committee bulletin, it was immediately disruptive. I mean, like, people started, you know, being ejected from the party, and people were put under scrutiny. People quit out of solidarity with other people being ejected, et cetera. People defected to other organizations. And it didn't seem like anyone thought, hey, maybe someone is fucking with us. And
that's a good way to put it. It's nobody asked kind of fundamental 101 questions. Who are these people? Show your face.
Oh, no, they thought maybe it was Trotskyist, which is, you know, fair guess. But they seem to not be too concerned with how, or maybe they were, I don't know, but they were just so easily manipulated into chaos. It's very surprising. And I think the book starts out with an anecdote about an informant that even fooled Lenin. And it just makes you wonder, how does this stuff get past people?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I was thinking about this before we got on the phone, too, is there's a legacy that gets passed down, and people are hesitant to confront their past. And as a result, they're going to be victimized by it again. You know, so Lenin had this guy, Roman Malinovsky, who got on the elevated to the Soviet, the Bolshevik Central Committee. He was one of three people charged with ferreting out spies, and he was a Tsarist agent, and he ended up getting exposed. I was just reading, too, around the same time, this group, the Socialist Revolutionaries in Russia, you know, they had a committee that undertook political violence, and this guy Yevno Azev was one of the three leading people on this committee, and he too was a Tsarist agent. So, you know, there's these people who get elevated historically to do damage, and then it gets exposed, and then nobody wants to talk about it because it doesn't quite fit into the political narrative. I mean, Lenin famously, in A Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, says, well, you know, this guy Malinovsky was a spy. On the one hand, he sent thousands of good comrades to prison or even death. On the other hand, because he allowed us to operate legally and distribute Pravda, you know, he recruited tens of thousands of Bolsheviks. And it's kind of a rationale. I mean, the logic is, if you strip away the logic, is, oh, well, geez, maybe we ought to have a lot more informants at the top of the organization. We see state power.
He does not want to admit that he got tricked and that it was bad. And then privately, he admitted it.
On a personal level, Lenin did confront it. But
yeah,
I think for political expediency, they passed down, well, you know, it's all good. And it's not all good. And a lot of the left kind of have this, to this day, this view that Malinovsky was not a problem. I mean, Malinovsky sent Stalin to Siberia. That's got to have had an effect on Stalin, right?
Right.
And how he viewed people and stuff. But that's another book to read, I guess, or write.
Right. Well, Lenin privately said, I never could see through that scoundrel Malinovsky. But I think there's there's some amount of shame to have to, you know, having been a mark. But it's, you know, this stuff is very real, and it's been historically very consistent, and it does seem like you have to keep your eyes open about it. In the intro to the book, actually, you have this final paragraph that says, as for the groups that were FBI targets, their response is instructive. Beyond the combination of disbelief, denial, and even acceptance of the Bureau's assaults was a mistaken view that a correct political line, the supremacy of their ideals, was sufficient to withstand the attacks, if not in the short run, then in the long run. How that worked in practice is a lesson in repeated failure, one with historic precedent. There's just no way to avoid
it. One of those hard truths. And the thing is you can either confront it, or you can continue on. You know, talk about Richard Aoki, who was this FBI informant from like the late 50s up into the mid 70s. And, you know, when it was exposed, he was an informant and a couple thousand pages of his file came out. The first reaction was no, it's not true. And then the second reaction was, oh, well, even if he was an informant, he was a piss poor one because he did more good than bad. But, you know, if you actually look at his record is he actually did more bad than good. You know, the statement doesn't stand on its own. And, you know, some of the people defending him actually deserve the accolades that he had. You know, these were folks who had fought for Asian American studies and social justice for you know, Asian people. They're defending this guy who had sold out or, you know, betrayed those interests at every point. It's a hard thing to confront, and you're dealing with people who, you know, you're dealing with complicated people who are really sneaky. And, you know, of course, they've got the advantage. They know they're lying. You don't. You know, it's on you to sort out truth from fact without making yourself crazy or torpedoing your political agenda in the process. But, you know, yeah, they've got an advantage. But the bigger sin, to use that religious term, is even after the fact, not excavating that ground. I think that's, I mean, I can make quite a few allowances for what people, you know, were subject to. But what doesn't make sense to me, or what I don't think I would accept, is that people have just let it go and acted like it never happened, or let's not reexamine it. I don't think that's helpful.
Sure, sure. Especially moving forward, we've seen that this stuff is effective, and if we don't learn from it, it's going to happen again. But I remember the Aoki thing very vividly because I remember a Japanese-American friend of mine just did not believe it. And then I think a Times article in like 2015 came out and she was like crying because this was a very important, you know, figure to her. And it's a really ugly truth to have to confront. But at the same time, like if you're not being infiltrated, it's probably because you're not a threat. And if you are a threat, you're probably being infiltrated.
Oh, geez. Well, that's a good point. Yeah, it's a badge of honor. I mean, don't get crazy about it. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Results matter a little more than your infiltration level. But thank you so much for coming on. It's a really wonderful book. I recommend it entirely. I think one of the most fascinating things about it is that you have all of these amazing documents at the end that people just get to pour through, and the utter just scope and pervasiveness of these programs is completely shocking. I'm relatively interested in this stuff, and I had absolutely no idea to the extent to which the left has been infiltrated. All right, Aaron J. Leonard, thank you so much for coming on. You can find A Threat of the First Magnitude out from Repeater Books in the show description. Go out and buy it. It's really fascinating.
Thank you for having me. It's a lot of fun. Fun is probably not the right word.
It's okay. We can admit that it's fun.
I always look forward to the opportunity to get into this with folks. So thank you.
All right. Thank you.